This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 98 of The Morning After. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I'm here live in Bushwick in Roberta's restaurant. Pizza day today, as always. I'm here without my co-host, Jessie Kiefer. She is spending her last day abroad in Paris today. I miss her terribly, and I cannot wait to hear about all the amazing natural wines she tasted in the Loire Valley and all the adventures that she had in France. So bon voyage, my dear Jessie. I look forward to seeing you next week across the table from me. Despite not having Jessie, I'm very, very excited about the show today. I have two very special guests. First, online, I have, online as in the phone, I have Brendan Spiro, who I'm assuming is there. Are you there, Brendan?
Yeah, I am. Thank you, Sari.
Hey, thank you. So nice to be hearing from you. We're going to be talking with you first about your position as food and beverage director at Play, which is the cafe at the Museum of Sex. And I know that you oversee the cafe and the bar. So with Valentine's Day looming, whether that's a good or bad thing to you, if you're listening, I'm not going to comment on that subject. We'll be talking about what you guys have in mind. And then also in studio today, I have my very beloved professor with me from NYU, from the Graduate Food Studies Department. She is the director of the graduate program, and she also teaches undergraduates, those lucky ducks who get to study food studies as an undergrad, which certainly didn't exist when I was an undergrad. But I also did want to mention that I spent my day yesterday at Le Picho, which is Joe Campanelli's Italian trattoria in the East Village, for Bloody Mary tasting event. I guess it was called Eat, Drink, and Bloody Mary, and I'm so lucky I got to be there. Because all I did was walk around and taste different Bloody Marys, which is definitely my perfect idea of how to spend a Sunday. And I was wondering from both you, Jennifer, and you, Brendan, do you guys like Bloody Marys? I mean, I found yesterday it was a bit controversial.
How can a Bloody Mary be controversial?
Well, some people don't like them. I mean, not everyone likes savory drinks, I guess.
Yeah, well, we explore that over here pretty in depth. I love the bloodies and all the variations. I like the green with the tomatillos and the martini ones with the strained tomato water, everything.
Ooh, yeah.
Bring it on.
I liked all the fishy ones yesterday. I liked Matthew Walters from Dover. He's a friend of mine, and he made the winning Bloody Mary cocktail, and it was like Thai food in a glass, which I really liked. There was like some anchovy paste and like kaffir lime and lemongrass, and it was all umami flavory. Is good. Right. Yeah. Do you guys have a favorite Bloody Mary in the city?
Jim is doing a tomato water, something called In a Pickle. So he makes it all umami'd out as well. So
oh, I want that. You had me a pickle.
He's got some shrooms with a cachaça infused, and then he strained
Wait,
some fresh
mushrooms and
water.
Cachaça.
You got it.
That's crazy.
With nampla in there as well, and yeah, it's a dynamite drink. He serves it up, so chilled martini style.
When can I drink that?
Whenever you like.
Perfect. okay, great. Moving away from mushroom drinks, why don't you? First, I want to know from you, Brendan, about the concept of the food and the drink over at Play. And I mean, I imagine there was a lot of thought that went into choosing the foods, because you guys are at the Museum of Sex, so there has to be thematic in some way. The foods have to be, I don't know, they have aphrodisiac qualities, or tell us what the thought process was when you were deciding the menus.
Yeah, you know, so the low-hanging fruit would probably be the whole aphrodisiac spin on the joint, but it took a little bit of a departure from that. What we wanted to do is really just explore kind of what the museum does, getting into some of the ideas of sensuality, pleasure, desire, how that plays in the medium of food and beverage, without being gimmicky, without using, the penis straws and, the bachelorette tiara.
Thank you for that.
although we like to have fun down here, and we're not going too highbrow and cerebral, but yeah. So the food has to be dynamic, a lot of flavor combos. The drink program that Jim Kearns put up is extremely well thought out. I personally have been working on the project for over 2 years. So aphrodisia comes into it, textures, flavor, all different sort of sensorial information. We want you to really experience the place much like an opportunity going through a museum. You know what I mean? You're investigating, you're being curious, you're checking out little scenes. Possibly there's a video installation on the wall, and then you get this crazy drink that someone cooked up. There's some fantastic food that can go with it. All very New York, very, you know, approachable in the sense that things make sense on the menu, but when you get in the mouth, we're hoping there's a bit of some tension and you know, a little bit of a risque feel and vibe. Mm-hmm.
So the tension I'm really curious about, is that a tension in terms of flavor combinations or ingredients that are used in ways that are kind of unexpected? Is there supposed to be a surprise of flavors that happens?
Exactly. So we play with the idea of surprise, mystery, sensuality, again, the cloaking of the veil, things that can be opened up, closed. We have plateware that sort of stacks upon one another, and the clients are really encouraged to order food in a bit of a tasting menu fashion, but they choose the tasting menu. Everything comes out sort of, again, stacked up almost like an Indian tiffin, and then we open it up and reveal all of these goodies.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
So Valentine's Day, I imagine you guys are cooking up something kind of special. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Valentine's Day down here, you know, we will be going down that road. We're offering some beautiful packages, but what's really interesting about them is not only can you just chill in the lounge, get some hors d'oeuvres, we're throwing in tickets to the museum itself, as well as a sex kit.
What's that?
So the museum.
Just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. the gratuitous lube and everything else that can get you.
Hi, Dad.
Get you going. So in the back, though, we are doing a 6-course tasting menu, and with that, we'll be doing some beverage pairing as well.
Great. Can you give us a little sneak peek of some of the food?
I can. So we have a fluke ceviche in one course that has ahi amarillo emulsion with a mezcal-infused pear, cilantro, and these toasted Ecuadorian corn grains, maíz tostado. And then one really, really beautiful dish that the chef concocted. This, I think, tells a little bit about the story and what I alluded to previously. So we have beets, right? They're smoked beetroot, which comes from actual infused smoke into the dish. And then we have a rocket salad with burrata in there, and there's some vermouth rose petal powder that's been thrown on the top. So
I really appreciate your use of the word rocket. You're very European.
Yeah, right. The arugula.
It's much sexier when you say rocket.
Right. But that's the interplay also with Jim and his beverage program and what the chef's doing in the kitchen. So Jim makes a drink called the Rosebud, and he infuses some Dolin Blanc with rose petals. So with the spent rose petals, the chef dehydrates and uses it as a nice powder to tip off his flavor combos with the beets.
So I have to ask, do you really think that there are such things as aphrodisiac properties in food, or do you think it's a little bit more of like mind over matter?
You know, I definitely believe in the idea of aphrodisia. It goes back millennium. We have tomes on it. The museum had lent us some pretty invaluable information. You know, licorice, obviously meant to create an increased circulation in the body. There's things that are super olfactory that, you know, harken to mind love and opportunity to be sensual and sexual. You know, thyme, rosemary.
Mm-hmm.
They used to bed Greek rooms with the smell of thyme. Days of old.
So it sounds like you did a lot of research when you were putting together this menu.
It's well thought out. I'm not going to say, you know, I got my PhD on aphrodisia, but, you know, we definitely...
Does that exist?
We wanted to research it and be as authentic as possible.
Well, that sounds great. So if you're single, could you, I mean, I don't know anyone who might want to do this, maybe me, come to the restaurant and then, like, the food could be your date?
Totally, totally. And and the bar is for the singles, of course.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're ready for you.
Okay. Good. I mean, not me, but, you know, my friend,
right.
who wants to have a very romantic evening with her food. Okay, that sounds awesome, Brendan. Thank you so much. Where can we, I mean, do we need to make a reservation? Do we need to get tickets? How does this work?
Yeah, so go to willyouplaywith.me, and you'll find all the information online. You can purchase the tickets there, or you can come into the museum and purchase them on the day of if you're sort of not... steady on plans.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you a happy Valentine's Day.
You too, Sari. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Okay, and we'll be back on the morning after, right after this break. We are here with Dr. Jennifer Schiffberg. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Got Away by Sleepies on heritageradionetwork.org.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host today, Sari Kamen, solo from my co-host, Jesse Kiefer, who's left me for Paris. But she's coming back, which I'm very excited about. So here in studio, I have someone very close to my own heart because she is my professor. I'm in the food studies department, the graduate department at NYU, New York University. In my last semester, I'm feeling sad to say. and Professor Berg has been with me since the beginning. I've had several classes with her. I've had food and culture. I've had field trips in New York, which was a wonderful excuse for a class where we ran around to different neighborhoods all over New York City, and she just wowed us with all of her amazing food knowledge in the depths of all the boroughs. And now she's with me in my final semester working on my final project. So I want to welcome to the studio Ms. Jennifer Berg. Hello.
Hello, Sari.
Oh, God, I'm so nervous. So you are the director of the Graduate Food Studies Program at NYU, which is just a really amazing thing, and it's a big old job. And what's really fantastic about you is that you actually did your PhD in food studies at NYU. Before taking over the entire department. So, you know, I think the first thing is I'd love to hear from you what your definition of food studies is. And I should preface this by saying that you were one of the people who defined the words in the Oxford Encyclopedia.
Right. It was back in 1995. We had a meeting at NYU. It was Marion Nessel, myself, and a group of sort of who's who in the food world. Imagine a room of 20 of the biggest sort of food egos and personalities in New York. Hard to pick just 20 of them. But we were in a room, and the idea was twofold. One was to get these great minds to come in, outside voices, and look at what we were doing. And at the time, it was a program in food service management. And our students were going off and they were getting jobs in corporate catering and that sort of, those sorts of fields.
Food and that's and beverage. What your background is, yes?
Sort of. So we wanted them to look at our curriculum, and at the same time, we wanted to throw out an idea that we had, and for lack of a better word, we'd call it food studies. And at the time, we were just thinking of it as sort of this intellectual and academic pursuit of all things food. Didn't have a very big definition of it, because we hadn't fully sort of fleshed it out at all. And at the end of this meeting, expecting them to say, this is insane, people were like, wow, I would do this, and I would have done this instead of getting a degree in anthropology or sociology or architecture or art or art history or American studies, or the list was on and on. Or theater. That was for you, sorry.
Thank you.
And so we left that meeting and then spent the next year putting together an assembling of courses and putting it through the state and getting all of those permissions and doing a national search for first full-time faculty member, who was Amy Bentley, who came. And so we started the program in 1996. We expected, two students, three, but Marion Burroughs had put it in the New York Times, and so our first semester we had 15 people. Hmm. Still was dumbfounded that they came to a program that, in a discipline that didn't exist anywhere, that had never been defined. It was the first food studies program in the States.
So not only were you one of the people who defined it, but you were also one of the people who invented it.
Yeah, we definitely say it was definitely an invention at NYU. It's exciting that there are lots of food studies courses at universities all over the country. There's still only a tiny handful of universities that offer full degree-granting programs in food studies. It's exciting when one does open up because it sort of validates the field. But you have to be a pretty risk-taking institution to go for broke and say, we're going to start a program that doesn't exist anywhere else. Mm-hmm. We couldn't provide any track record. We just, will it work was the question. And we were like, we hope so. We think so.
Yeah.
Food is the greatest. It must. But we really had no idea.
Food is the greatest.
It is the greatest.
I'm like staring at someone's pizza and Roberta's right now.
I know. I'm looking at the glass, which is actually quite clean, but I'm sort of...
Yeah, they can see you know.
I don't really care. I'm hoping if they see my hand reaching over, they'll walk into the studio and give me a slice.
I'm going to make that happen later. So what was food studies like in that first very young year?
In those really early years in 1996, 1997, I always say it's sort of the pre-9/11 era. Mm. So we were not talking about things like think global, eat local, sustainable food, tainted food supply, bioengineered food, GMOs, the stuff that we kind of will talk about all the time and think that it is in the lexicon of, natural vocabulary for everybody on a daily basis. We weren't talking about that. Almost exclusively, every one of our graduate students wanted to be a, quote, food writer. And they were really interested in, I'm looking at the pizza again, sorry, at what the pizza meant, what that decision meant about them culturally. And so the focus was very different. It was very much on the consumption side of food, on the pleasure side of food. Remember, just you can't look at something without the construction of the time period that it's in. Mm-hmm. And so in the mid-1990s, this is way pre-recession. This is pre-9/11. We are really, New York is in the throes of restaurant culture. There is such a sort of a hedonistic pleasure attitude. I'm not saying this just because it's right for Valentine's Day, but we really were in this incredible, joyful, pleasure-oriented focus around food. And so our students were a microcosm of that. They wanted to look at food in its pleasure principles. And most of the early students were a little older. The average age in the beginning was 34. They were coming out of professional kitchens. It was a lot of professional cooks and chefs who felt like their brain was, as a muscle, was going through atrophy, and they wanted to think, not just produce. And so it was a lot of very tactile practitioners around food. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was my people. in some way. Yeah. That was kind of more my background as well.
Yeah. Was there an emphasis on tracing food from a historical context and a cultural context the way that there still is now?
There was. There probably was more so because that's all we were really doing in the beginning. You know, we used to say in the definition early on, almost 20 years ago, that food studies is, you know, the intersection of culture and history and how those relate to food. Mm-hmm. And obviously that definition has broadened, you know, over the almost last two decades. But in the beginning, it really was about culture and history. And if it was tracing it, as the word you used, it wasn't tracing it the way we think of, or a lot of our food systems colleagues talk about it today, you know, tracing food from farm to table or tracing food along the distribution channels, but it was tracing it historically and all of those cultural.
Mm-hmm, but not in a Michael Pollan kind of sense.
Yes. And I'm really glad you said that, because it's also this is that. It's the pre-recession, pre-9/11, and pre-Michael Pollan era.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's like, you know, food studies has two different kind of channels or tracks right now. It's food and culture, and then food systems. And I mean, and I personally love the program because I think that those, you can't really have one without the other in this day and age. And, you know, they intersect in such a meaningful and challenging way. But it sounds like this was pre-food systems.
It was pre-food systems. And about 10 years into the program, at that point, we had practically tripled our faculty. We had Krishnendu Ray came, and so it's Amy Bentley, myself, Krishnendu Ray. We came back to the table and kind of tried to do a soul searching on what we had done for 10 years. You know, we were really proud of what we had done, for sure, but also we recognized that there were things that we weren't doing, and that was we really weren't looking at this whole first part of the food equation mm-hmm. and the production side, and we were really all focusing on the consumption side. Partly it was more of our interests, definitely the interests of the students. And we didn't live in a world in the beginning when we just didn't care about it in the same way. I mean, the front page of the New York Times every single day is about something in the global food system. But that is a pretty recent phenomenon of the last, you know, 8 or 10 years.
Right. Well, so is processed food in a lot of ways. And, you know,
the thinking about it. I mean, processed food is, you know, came to a boom in the middle part of the 20th century. But, you know, when processed food came in, it was like a panacea. It was really exciting. And it was embraced by the affluent classes mm-hmm. because it was science, it was technology, it was innovation, it was creativity. You know, to have cake mixes in your closet was a sign of status. Mm-hmm. And that's been completely flipped today. So when we think about processed food, it is like, you know, we want to put garlic out. It's sort of the evil one, processed food.
Yeah.
We don't sort of see it in that sophisticated way.
Right.
Or in any kind of a glamorous way that we maybe saw it in the...
And I think that word Monsanto, you know, even if people don't really know what it is, they it's very pejorative. I mean, to most people. Even if
they don't know what Monsanto is.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Right. If there's not like a comprehensive understanding of what GMOs are, of, you know, that whole food chain there. We know it's bad.
I don't know what the we is. I guess the we is this bi-coastal food thinking population.
Yeah, like the larger population that has some sort of consciousness towards like understanding that they're supposed to be eating healthy and, you know.
I guess anybody who's listening to The Morning After.
Well, I actually have over 1 million listeners. So, yes, all of those.
Okay.
No, I don't.
And once again, Sarah, your 3,000, your 3 million tweeting followers have all bought into that same Kool-Aid message.
Okay. Well, I acknowledge I live in a bit of a bubble when it comes to food.
I live in that as well.
Yeah. NYU, mm-hmm. New York City, Heritage Radio Network at large. Yes. But it's okay because we're right. So speaking of pizza,
hallelujah.
I read something today that I didn't know about you. And that is, not only did you define food studies, but you also created the definition for pizza?
Oh, that sounds a little bold. There was...
Well, please explain. Enlighten me.
It wasn't... I'm trying to remember when this was. I'm thinking it was also maybe the late 90s when all of the large publishing houses were going sort of a race to the finish line to create their own food encyclopedias. We went from having zero to, you know, like 6 big volumes, you know. And so one of them, I think it was Scribner's, I should remember this, I've looked at a CV, but wanted an entry on the history of pizza. And at the time, I was dabbling in my dissertation topic, and pizza was going to be part of it. So I thought, okay, well, I can spend the summer doing this history of pizza. And I was doing it with Cara Da Silva, the food historian and writer. And so we wrote it together. And then pizza never made it into the dissertation. But but it was really fun. And it was one of those incredibly fun folk histories, because there's nothing definitive. You know, it goes on for pages and pages, but there's this big sort of academic disclaimer in every paragraph, which is like, it could be version A, according to folkloric traditions, ... pizza, whatever, or many people believe that, you know, there were all of these disclaimers, because it's really,
yeah,
since the beginning of time, so, post-fire invention, people have been throwing some kind of a dough on a fire.
Yeah. So what is there a way to summarize what you kind of came up with? I mean, obviously, it sounds like there was a couple different variations, but...
I mean, we, you know, say the Etruscans, you know, some of the earliest civilizations, you know, found some concoction of some grain, wheat, some heritage grain that we're now bringing back and applauding and exalting, combined it with some sort of, you know, wet substance and put it over a fire.
Preferably edible.
Maybe, maybe not.
Preferably made from a tomato. I guess tomatoes didn't even exist.
Tomatoes are so late. That's like a recent blip of history. But they really, you know, obviously becomes popularized, you know, in Italy in the 19th century when you start seeing the, you know, the beginning of the unification in Italy, and you're seeing, you know, tomato as a product that is really becomes emblematic, even if it's a brand new food to Italy. Mm-hmm. And once it becomes into the royal courts, it becomes codified, and then the masses eat it.
Yeah.
So, you know, like any kind of food tradition, it either starts from the very top or the very bottom. The middle just does nothing. They wait for the trend to happen. Whether they're looking down at the trend, like at polenta, or they're looking up at the trend, like, you know, truffles or caviar. And so pizza sort of starts at the bottom, becomes codified at the top.
I love that.
And then becomes global.
Like lobster.
Like lobster. And we've spent a lot of time talking about lobster. Yes.
That's
now
great.
You're supposed to say, hi, Dad. Talking about lobster.
Hi, Dad. Talking about lobsters. On the radio. I can tell you're not listening to you because you're not texting me. So getting back to food studies, we're going to take a break, but if there's a way to kind of truncate what food studies was and then what food studies is now, is there a way to define?
I can do this really quickly, I promise. So in the beginning, food studies was really, how do I decide what to eat? And what does that decision say about me as an individual or my society? What does it mean culturally or historically? So it was really about what we ate, what we thought about eating. But from a culture standpoint, and now it's the definition is just broadened. So it hasn't discarded that, but that's a piece of it. So it's really looking at food from its earliest incarnations of production through consumption and into post-consumption. And all of those decisions that go into food. I obviously, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid. I believe it more than anything else. Food is the epicenter. It is the most important thing. It's clearly the most interesting thing to study, to think about, to talk about. There isn't anything in human society that we could look at, you know, whether it's, you know, sex, romance, relationships, parenting, anything without seeing the value and the role that food plays in it. So now we, you know, we look at it from environmental and ethical implications around that, environmental, ecological, globalization, any huge phenomena or area of inquiry that's going on in the world, we can just slam food studies right smack center. And we do. Good. We do.
Yes.
We do.
Yes, we do. Okay. That's lovely, Jennifer. Right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk more food studies.
You're listening to Setback by Sleepies on heritageradionetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm in studio. I've been talking with Jennifer Berg. She is a professor at the NYU Food Studies Department, and she's the director of the Graduate Food Studies Program, also in Steinhardt at NYU. So we've been talking a little bit about what the definition of food studies is, and it's been really interesting to listen to the evolution since the program has been around since about 2006.
1996. Right?
That's what I meant. Yep.
What's a decade?
skip a little bit. So Jennifer actually did her dissertation. She did her PhD in food studies at NYU, which she's now ruling. And you did your dissertation in Jewish food and culture and identity in New York City. I know I'm not saying this perfectly, but you had like a wonderful name for it. So I would love to hear what drew you to, I mean, I know you're a born and raised New Yorker.
Yes, I am a born and raised New Yorker.
You're like the most New York-y person I've ever met in my life.
I am.
You're the most proud New Yorker
I've ever. Guilty as charged, yes. I'm gonna take that as a compliment.
Absolutely. Absolutely a compliment. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And so what really drew you to the Jewish food ways?
It wasn't a dissertation that I came to immediately. I was originally going to do something. I was interested in this group of Jews living in the southwestern part of the United States, in Arizona and New Mexico, who had discovered that they were Jewish, grown up Roman Catholic, practicing Catholicism, and they were descendants of Murano Jews who had converted during the Inquisition over 500 years ago. Wow. And that was a really interesting, and I had just read some newspaper articles about it. But at the time, I had tiny little babies at home, you know, like a 1.5-year-old toddler and a nursing newborn. And so it was impractical with a full-time job and two babies to do field research, you know, across the country. And then I thought about doing something. I was doing it with a Syrian Sephardic woman in Brooklyn. It was going to be a gender studies thing of three generations of women in one family and doing oral histories of these three women. And I did that for about a year, did a lot of interviews with them. But at the end of the day, you know, I wasn't really particularly interested in what I was doing, and I couldn't imagine people were going to read something if I wasn't even interested in it. And so I took about a year off just kind of thinking about what was it about food that I loved more than anything. And I come out of practice of food, out of professional kitchens, but I really didn't want to do anything restaurant-y. I really wanted to do something sort of street-ish. And so I realized it wasn't so much the Jewish studies thing as it was the focus around New York. And so I spent about a year, I asked everybody, if you think about New York, what foods do you think of? And I just cataloged lists and lists and lists. And so everything was, that's why the pizza thing was in there. Mm-hmm. Because pizza by the slice, which is a very New York thing, people kept saying, but the other things were like bagels and smoked fish.
Yes.
And deli meat and knishes and black and white cookies. And so I kept hearing the same things. And it was kind of funny that there was this sort of oxymoron going on here that in New York, like the epicenter, and I could take it on with anybody in California, in sort of like the birth and the fuel and the excitement of food in this country is in New York, and yet in all the highbrow restaurants. And again, this is in the, you know, late 1990s, restaurant culture is thriving, booming in New York. And yet people of all socioeconomic backgrounds, new New Yorkers, old New Yorkers, transplanted New Yorkers, wealthy New Yorkers, anybody is saying all these things that you like hot dogs, things you eat on the street. Mm-hmm. And except for pizza, they all were sort of quote Jewish origin, whatever that meant. And so to make a clean dissertation, it was like cutting off an arm to take the pizza out. No, because I was like, so yeah. Pizza fixated, not just because I am sitting in Roberta's and wanting to eat a slice of pizza now, but I was pretty pizza focused, but I had to kind of take that out to make it a clean analysis. And so the dissertation is called From Pushcart Peddler to Gourmet Takeout, New York City's Food of Jewish Origin. And it spans the 20th century from 1920, the end of the big, quote, mass migration, up until 2005. It was like supposed to be 2000, but it takes a long time to finish a dissertation, so the title kept changing, 2000, 2001, 2002.
Yeah. Well, I had the pleasure of taking one of your classes where it was the best class. We went to different neighborhoods every week, once a week, and we explored the different kind of underground food trends and cultures that existed. Definitely on the streets, you know your way around the blocks. And I think the first week actually, we went to the Lower East Side and we tasted the knishes and we did cats and we did the pickles. And I mean, not even just that week, but your knowledge of New York food is just unparalleled. I mean, it's just insane. Like, you know the history of buildings. You know things about streetlights. I mean, you just walk down the street. If anyone ever gets a chance to like hang out and have lunch with Jenny, make sure you're just out on the streets and you're just, you know, noshing along, because it is the most fascinating and delicious experience. So I'm curious, in your research, and I want to know a little bit about how you pursued mm-hmm. your research, but what did you discover that was surprising to you?
I guess I discovered a couple of things that were really shocking. One was, you always hear that memory and nostalgia are fuzzy, but that made me realize just how fuzzy it was. There were people, and I did a lot of interviews with men who were in their late 80s. Everybody was saying, oh, can you interview my father? He really needs somebody to talk to. So it was a lot of those sorts of interviews. And they would talk nonsense. I would just ask them, I didn't even say this is about food. I would just say, I just want to kind of talk to you about your life on the Lower East Side, or I want to talk to you about your life in, you know, on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, or I want to talk to you about your life living in the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. And invariably within 5 minutes, they were talking about food. Mm-hmm. And then it would go on for 2 hours while they talked about food. And yet, I was looking at all the historical newspapers from the 20s. There are 28 English language papers that I looked at from the 1920s through the 1980s. I read every single one of the English language ones, 28 of them. And there were zero, absolutely not five or six, zero articles about food spanning all those decades. And so there was this disconnect between what people are believing to be true memory of their experiences and actually the value of food that is going on in that time period. So that was a really telling, sort of alarming distinction that was going on.
When was it painful for people to talk about food? I mean, were a lot of the memories associated, I imagine, with memories, you know, from times when they were living in Europe or around World War II? I mean, I would think that food could be a catalyst for some very kind of deep, submerged
pain. That's a great question, Sari. I was only talking to people who, about their experiences with food in New York. I wasn't asking them any sort of questions. I was really talking to people who had grown up in New York, so I wasn't talking to anybody who had, let's say, were living in Europe and left, you know, right before World War II. I was talking to people who were formerly living in New York. What was interesting was that the other thing is that all of the food were things that we think of, or as like my family will say, is Jewish soul food.
Uh-huh. So
bagels, lox, typical sort of Sunday morning fare. And so that was food that was eaten and consumed a lot by first and second generation immigrants in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but not kind of the way you and I and your 14 million followers think about food. Hi, Dad. People weren't thinking about food. People were just, they were just eating the food. Okay. They were eating the bagels, but not deconstructing it intellectually in their heads. And then in the middle part of the 20th century, there was a disdain for sort of anything that was would kind of pull them down socially. So those markers of early ethnicity or early immigration. And so when they were moving out of New York City and climbing a socioeconomic ladder and becoming wealthier and in part striving to become, quote, whiter, there wasn't any discussion or even an outward display of eating these foods. And so it was much more sort of embracing mid-20th century American sort of bland, white.
Yeah, I guess that's very understandable.
You know, Jell-O mold type food.
Perfection salad.
Yes. Yeah. And so now, you know, it's very hip to embrace anything sort of ethnic.
It is. And it's very hip to kind of reinvent nostalgia.
Absolutely. And especially, you know, for a group that has been really fortunate in terms of economic, financial, social success, you know, across the guys, you know, Jews are a tiny population in New York. It's a very significant population, but it's also just a very significantly noticeable population and successful, however one deems to define success. But if you're going to throw money into it and stature, it has been a successful population.
Well, it's certainly
and so
a
it's
population
easy,
yeah. that's closely associated with their food.
But now it is. That was what I argued.
Uh-huh.
That I put it into three different time periods,
yes.
three phases. And so this third phase that I call Aliyah, or coming back, this sort of symbolic return to, you know, Yiddishkeit or Jewish culture, not religion, but just sort of a culture. It's kind of, it's cool. It's hip to embrace something that maybe your parents or your grandparents kind of disdained because it was a marker of being a dirty new immigrant. Now it's a marker of, it's kind of like ghetto chic.
Yeah.
It's okay to eat these
once
seemingly disdainful foods because you can kind of, the grunge factor, you are very successful.
But they've certainly been elevated, I think.
And now they're repackaged.
They are, yeah.
It's,
and it's interesting that, I mean, you didn't touch on this in your dissertation, it sounds like, but so many of those foods are sort of embedded with, you know, the cultures of Eastern Europe and, you know, a time that was extremely painful. And, what am I trying to say here? The way that those foods have been repackaged in modern days in New York City, it's like that association has been removed from it. Like, by making it hip and by making it trendy, it's like you can still sort of play with these Eastern European ingredients, but it's sort of like removed from the heritage, or at least like the painful part of the heritage.
Right. It's taken all the Europe-ness out of it. Because these foods came over just prior to World War II, late 19th century, early 20th century, and painful memories of Europe in, you know, the years leading up to World War II and post-World War II, that was not an association that people wanted. So even something like the bagel, which most people, folklore says, is probably attributed to Czechoslovakia, there's something, it's totally attributed to New York today.
Mm-hmm.
So even in Israel, you see, you know, bagel stores are called New York bagels.
Right.
Because it's a whole new brand of food.
Yeah.
Like, it's New York Jewish food.
Yeah. And it's definitely easier to process that way.
And it has nothing to do with religion.
Uh-huh. Well, right.
Because none of the Jewish foods that I was looking at, I wasn't looking at anything that had any religious significance. I wasn't looking at matzah. I wasn't looking at anything that had any ritualistic significance.
Sure.
I was looking at food that actually has nothing to do with Jews. It was just that Jews ate it. You know, they consumed it, and then they began producing it and marketing it.
Yeah.
And but then the next step was they owned it.
Yeah. But now we're even seeing this trend of even those religious food kind of being co-opted by, you know, some very sort of Brooklyn-y artisanal, mm-hmm. you know, gefilteria, for one.
Right.
I mean, how many people are eating gefilteria or, you know, thinking about it and then, like, really thinking about the significance and the religious symbolism behind it? Maybe some people know a little bit, but, I mean, that's just not what the point.
It's not what the point is at all. I mean, I think the point is that some things follow different trends, and so something can be humiliating or self-degrading, and then when you have a confidence marker, you can go ahead and embrace it again. But we see this is not really just a quote Jewish thing. I mean, Irish immigrants have had that with the potato. There were some Irish immigrants who would never ever eat a potato here in the United States because it was a marker of, you know, the most horrible moment in modern Irish history of the famine.
Mm-hmm.
And some people found that eating the potato was a marker of empowerment to say, look at where we came from and look at what we have.
It.
Or the whole thing was soul food in this country.
Yeah.
There were African Americans who would never eat anything that was remotely associated with a remnant of slavery and now will as an empowerment movement. So
yeah.
I don't think my story that I was translating was that different.
Yeah.
But so much more interesting.
Oh my gosh. I could talk forever about this. But what I'm interested in, you've really been with the food studies program the whole time. You've seen the entire trajectory from 1996 till now. What do you think comes next?
That is a good question. And the deans will ask me that a lot. I see the trend, let's say, over the last 10 years. It's become much more intellectual in terms of the students, and I think people are thinking food so much. I would like to see, and I hope that this is the future, not just because I want it, but I would like not to see us reducing the thinking that we're doing, but I would like to see us going back to the roots of it, which is the doing. And I think to think about food without producing food, it becomes just an intellectual exercise.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that part of it is the baggage I bring to the table because I come from production, and I think that the craft of food, and I'm not saying it in that sort of Brooklyn-esque, like nobody was ever producing food as a craft until, you know, 5 years ago. I'm just saying it as working with one's hands. I mean, I think that is the beauty of food versus so many other types of, quote, studies that one can do, is that we're not just looking at a phenomenon, but we're looking at an actual thing, and we're looking at something that is an art and also something that is ephemeral and something that is day-to-day basic. But we can't think it unless we're doing it, and that is touching it, feeling it, sensing it, consuming it, loving it, appreciating it, saving it. So I want to insert the human back into it, the human body, mm-hmm. not just the human brain.
Wow.
And I'm going to have to believe that is the future of food studies.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm sure all of you listeners can see why I do not want to graduate. I want to stay taking classes with Jennifer Berg forever. And ever. And I just can't thank you enough for being here today and for also just being one of the biggest inspirations that I've ever had academically.
Well, you are a star.
Oh.
We're expecting more greatness from you.
I hope I can follow through with that. All right. So that's it for us today on The Morning After. Thank you to Brendan Spiro from Play in the Museum of Sex. And thank you to Jennifer Berg, my very esteemed professor. See you next week. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.